Yesterday, I have talked about Dirac fermions, and in particular Dirac fermions in 1 plus 1D. So I've introduced what is this soliton solution and so on. So I will continue with these discussions. In particular, I will make a few remarks about this soliton solutions. Let's continue with this 1 plus 1D Dirac fermions. So just to remind you that the lattice model that we have for this 1 plus 1D Dirac fermions is really just Hoppings that we have the, let's say, just nearest neighbor Hoppings on 1D chain, and then you get Dirac fermions, right? And then the Dirac fermions are gapless here, and its gaplessness is protected by the translation symmetry. And then to break the to gap it out, one way of doing it is that you add a Hopping that is moderated in space, and then in this Hamiltonian, the Dirac fermions will be gapped out, right? And this is called SSH model. So that's the story of Dirac fermions. And then one very interesting physics is that if you consider what people call the soliton, that in this context, then you will get very interesting solutions that have zero mode and also fractional charges. So just remind you that one way to think about soliton solutions is that now we just consider first quantized Hamiltonian for Dirac series. That is just sigma z times I minus I partial x and plus a mass term mx times sigma x, and one very important thing for soliton is that this mass term is space dependent, and then we consider a situation that the mass changes sign in my let's say at x equal to zero, and then at near this kink, they will get soliton solutions. So in reality, this soliton becomes very important if you consider the case that, let's say, in this SSH model, and indeed that is what happened microscopically, let's say in materials, is that you have some, what you do have is, let's say, some bosonic mode phi j coupled with this Hopping, and then phi j. One way to think about this phi j is that it's, let's say, it's just some described by the transversal Ising model or things like that, and then this this phi j, this bosonic mode, can be spontaneous break Z2 symmetries, meaning that it can either take phi j, can either take, I should still have this minus j here. Phi j can either take value, let's say m and minus m. So with m be, m is a positive number, so then those two state degenerate. Right, that is what happens microscopically, and then that's why in that case this soliton solution is very realistic. Right, that's really just like for this phi bosonic degree freedom that you just create a domain wall. Right, so in the bosonic degree freedom, and that domain wall can actually move without really cost you extra energy, that then that becomes a valid excitation in your system, right? That's why microscopically it's really very important to consider such excitations, right? So that is the microscopic reason that why we want to consider soliton here, and then a very important physics for this soliton is that it has a localized solution for Dirac fermions whose energy is precisely zero, right? And yesterday we have tried to solve that, and then today let me just give you the result. What does this soliton solution looks like? So it's really just take a very simple form that has an exponential decay factor that makes it just localize near x equal to zero, right? Remember that I'm just considering a simple limit that, let's say, my mass term takes value m1, let's say, at x larger than zero, and minus m2 at x smaller than zero, right? And those m1 and m2 are just a positive number. And then you can easily verify that if I'm applying this Hamiltonian to my this soliton solution, what I will get is we can do it immediately here. Let's say it will get what I will have is let's do it slowly. My Hamiltonian is a matrix with I partial x mx I partial x, and then I multiply it to this I1 and exponential, right? And my mass term is just take a simple form here, and then what I get is minus I, what I get is I mx 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 and minus I mx, right? And it equals to zero, right? So it's very easy to verify that this solution indeed has a zero energy, right? And as I said, it's always an eigenstate of my Hamiltonian, regardless what's the value of m1, m2 is taken, right? That already smells non-trivial, right? And its all energy is always zero. And the really remarkable thing is that even if the mass term take a much more non-trivial profile, not just a step function, I still get zero mode solutions. Its energy is always precisely zero, right? And as I said, that is comes from that has topological origin, and related to this this index, what people call the index of the Dirac operators. So I will not really go very go deeper on this, but let me just write a few remarks. The first thing is that, as I said, right, so the zero mode is topological, meaning that it will not be sensible about what are the actual profile of my mass as long as it changes sign. So and it's related to the uh, a single index theorem of Dirac operators. It's a mathematical theorem in topology, and indeed a similar story also exists for higher dimensional theories like 3+1D Dirac fermions. And another very fascinating physics about the soliton solution is that soliton actually has a fractional charge. One half, right? There's a very rigorous way of to demonstrate it. Here I will not do it, but instead I will just give you some a simple argument that to say why we should expect that soliton has a fractional charge. It's again related to that I have exactly zero energy state. Here. Okay, so we can compare it with, let's say, the normal case where I don't have a soliton, I don't have a zero mode, and then for Dirac theory, I just get, let's say, a two band, let's say, and this band is what we call a Dirac C, right? Let's say that's our zero energy. Right. Remember, the energy spectrum of Dirac fermions is like plus minus let's say k squared plus m squared. Right. So then this band is the Dirac C, and this is a positive energy state. Right. And then the vacuum is defined by that. I fill all the state. In the Dirac C, right? That's my vacuum, and normally the vacuum should have zero energy, sorry, zero charge. So let's say the vacuum has zero charge, right? And then what you can do is that then you can start to talk about charge one excitation and so on, right? And to get a charge excitation, what you do is that, say, I'm just creating a particle to my vacuum, and then this will be charge one, right? And a very important symmetry in this system is that I have what we call the charge conjugation, right? I can apply a charge conjugation or particle symmetry, right? Right. That's really just I just change all the occupied state to be unoccupied and vice versa, right? And then once I apply a charge conjugation to this, I will get a state that remove one particle in my Dirac C, right? And here this energy E is a positive number, so that's why here I'm annihilate one state in my vacuum, and here I get charge minus one, right? Everything is consistent about assigning charges to my excitations, to my vacuum. Okay, and now we can consider the case that I have soliton. Again, the situation are very similar, that I have my Dirac C's and I have my unoccupied state. But now the actual ingredient I have is at zero energy, I precisely have one state, right? I have one state whose energy is precisely zero. Now let's again try to play the game that how do we assign charges here? The key is that now I have two state. My ground state has twofold degeneracy, right? Because I can choose to occupy this state or not to occupy it, right? Those two state has exactly degeneracy. Let me call it vacuum minus and a vacuum plus, right? And then another thing is that under a charge conjugation, the minus state goes to plus state, right? Because let's say I'm just considering a situation that I'm not occupying zero mode and I'm occupying all the state of in my Dirac C, right? Now I'm doing a charge conjugation, then I'm occupying all the and then I will occupy the zero mode, right? That's why they're charge conjugate to each other. And another thing that we know is actually I should say it earlier, that is the charge of those two states will differ by one, right? Because the difference is that here I feel one actual zero mode, right? So that means, let's say if its charge is Q, and then its charge is Q plus one, right? Because I put one actual state there. And then the other thing is that they are related by the charge conjugation, right? It means that their charge should be opposite, right? And then the only solution for that is that I have Q equal to minus 1/2, right? And the other state will has Q equal to plus 1/2, right? That's why in the solid tone, in the end, indeed we have a fractional charge associated with this solid tone background. And yeah, so that's how we get the fractional charge in the solid tones. So and one really remarkable thing is that this fractional charge actually has been observed experimentally in these polymers, organic polymers that I have talked about. Okay, I don't know how to do it. Okay. Let me still write it here. So as I said, that this fractional charge has been observed in this organic polymers. So let's say it has been realized in materials and in particular this organic polymer and you might be wondering that why it makes sense at all, right? Because let's say we consider condensed matter systems, right? There's no so it's made of electrons and there's no quarks, right? In our model, and how can we end up with observing fractional charges, right? And the way out is that those solitons always appears in pairs, right? Just imagine that I have a periodic chain, right? And the soliton comes from this mass domain walls, right? And you can really just draw, as I said, you can kind of think that really they are really domain walls of some Ising spin degree of freedoms, right? And then if I create a domain wall somewhere, then I should always have another domain wall, right? Right. Always have two domain walls. And then at each domain wall, I have 1/2 charge. Then in total, I have integer charges, right? That's why in reality, it doesn't contradict with anything fundamental. And that's also how we get fractional charges in real systems. Another comment that I can make is that it's related to the what people called chiral anomaly of Dirac fermions. So it's in some sense you can say it's a consequence of chiral anomalies, but I don't think I have time to say much about this. But if you're interested, you can try to search related literatures to explore all those things. So yesterday I gave you a review article about this Dirac solitone solutions. I can give you another one that is more condensed matter-ish. It's a condensed matter review articles about reviewing the physics of these organic polymers and related solitons and fractional charges. So the review is written by Heger, Kivelsen, Schaefer, and Sue. Right, it's those three persons are really this SSH. And Heger, actually, I think he got a Nobel Prize actually for just for this organic polymer in chemistry. So, and Schaefer is actually also the famous BCS, the S of the BCS. So the paper is in the Review of Modern Physics.
The argument of why we can find the charge to be minus a half for the solid
zone? It's here, right? So we consider there are two states, right? There are two vacuums, right? And those two vacuums, one that corresponds to that I'm not occupying the zero mode, the other corresponds to that I'm occupying the zero mode, right? So then if one has charge Q, the other should have Q plus one, right? Because putting one actual state there, right? And then the other thing that we notice is that those two vacuum actually related by charge conjugation, right?
Why is that?
Because once I'm doing charge conjugation, let's say then I'm occupying all the, the charge conjugation, let's say maps the unoccupied state to occupied, right? Then I'm occupying, if I start with a state that not occupying the zero mode, then I will occupy the zero mode, right? Yeah. And that means Q should equals, minus Q should equals Q plus one, right? And then Q is minus 1/2.
Can you also find this charge by like doing like an explicit calculation?
Yeah. It's been written in a QFT-ish calculation is written in the review article that I provided yesterday. And I think this paper also has a condensed matter ish derivation for that. So I think that's all I want to say about 1 plus 1D Dirac fermions. Are there any other questions?
So when you say Q equals minus half,
yeah,
that's the, is that the total charge of the system in the vac minus?
Let's say the, yeah, that's the, the charge of the state that you fill all the Dirac C. Yeah, it's just like in the normal case, if you fill all the Dirac C, right, you will say the charge is zero.
Yeah.
Right, right. It's just like our vacuum, right, the universe really being, right, has all the Dirac C field. All right, maybe let me use board here. Now let's go to one dimensional higher, that's 2 plus 1D. We're gonna consider 2 plus 1D Dirac fermions. So as you probably know that for this 2 plus 1D Dirac fermions, one very famous materials realize it is the what we call the graphene, right? That's really just one layer of graphite and that's really a very important subject in quantum matter, right? Starting from maybe two decades ago, when experimentalists first find a way to get one layer graphene, and then this becomes a huge industry in quantum matter, and even nowadays there are a lot of very interesting physics you can get out from this graphene, right? One fascinating properties of the graphene is that indeed you will get this 2 plus 1D Dirac fermions. So, and it will be about, it will be what I'm going to talk about. Similar to this 1 plus 1D Dirac fermions, we can just start with a very simple tight bending models on a lattice to understand the graphene. So here the lattice structure of graphene is the what we call the honeycomb lattice. So I have let's say a honeycomb lattice not drawing a good honeycomb lattice, but I guess everyone knows what honeycomb lattice is. So I have a honeycomb lattice, and then I have fermions sitting at each side of the honeycomb lattice, and then they hop to its nearest neighbor. So that is basically the Hamiltonian. So we can A feature of honeycomb lattice is that in each in its translation, only invariant unit cell, it has two sides, right? Like this, like those two sides, and then it constitutes the unit cell of the honeycomb lattice. So usually we can call it A sub lattice and B sub lattice, right? And then to write down the Hamiltonian and also solve it, we need to first, we call those unit vectors, E1, E2, and E3. We just define the unit vector of on those three bound of honeycomb lattice. And then write down the Hamiltonian. So again, as I said, I'm just considering a tight bending Hamiltonian on a honeycomb lattice. Right? It's just the usual one that I'm minus t times the hopping. Here I'm considering a 2D lattice. Then I need to sum over all the lattice sides, and I have hopping, say dagger times. Say B, the position of this point is x plus EI, And I'm also summing over. Yeah, shoot, not use x. I'm summing over all the x, the size of all, a, and also summing over all the three unit vectors. So that is the how does the Hamiltonian look like, right? And then as you can imagine that to solve this Hamiltonian, I'm just using the Fourier transformation, right, to solve it. So to do that, we also need to define two actual vectors. Let's say that is my A1, and yeah, shoot, draw it like this, and this is A2. So and this A1 will be let's say E3 minus E2, right, and it equals to root 3 over 2 and 3 over 2, right? And A2 will be E3 minus E2 and equals to minus root 3 over 2 and 3 over 2, right? That's the that's indeed my the vector that the basis vector for my unit cell, right? And then doing a Fourier transformation, I won't write the Fourier transformation explicitly here. I think you have already saw it many times. So then I get the Hamiltonian in the momentum space, which take a form that summation of all the momentum and then minus t times say a k dagger, say b k dagger, right, and times a matrix that. So since I only have hopping between a and b, right, then I will not have diagonal matrix element. So I will only have off diagonal matrix element, and it's like 1 plus minus k dot a1 plus exponential minus I k dot a2, and it's the other element is just its conjugate, 1 plus k minus a1 plus plus e I k plus a2, right, and 0. So that's my Hamiltonian, and then it's again it's just a 2x2 matrix, right? You can solve it very easily, and you can get its energy band, the energy levels to be let's say, again it's epsilon k equals to plus or minus t root. 1 plus cosine k dot a1 plus cosine k dot a2 and square plus sine k dot a1 plus sine k dot a2 and square, right? So I think you have seen this multiple times, right? This kind of energy levels multiple times, right? And you can let's say using Mathematica to plot what does this band structure look like, and what you will find is that actually it will looks like something like this. But here I'm just drawing. 2D version of some 2D cut of it, right? But the key is that there will be some special point that those EK equal to zero, right? And then at those special point, those two bands just touch each other, right? And this again will become the Dirac cones in the low energy, right? And those Dirac cones, the Dirac points, at what we usually call them as k point and minus k point, which will be at 4 pi over 3 times root 3 and 0. Right, those are the position of Dirac points. So you can easily verify that once my momentum take this value, right, and the energy will be 0. Okay, that's why in this Dirac fermion, in this honeycomb lattice with nearest neighbor hopping, I will get Dirac points. So then the game is very simple. It's very similar to what we did in 1 plus 1D, right? Then we consider the excitations near my Dirac cone, right? And then I will get Dirac fermions and so on, right? So that is a story of the graphene. And let me see, what should I say? So now let's try to do this again. That's to get this Dirac Hamiltonian and to understand its physics, similar to this 1 plus 1D. So that's called this guy FK. So now what we want to do is that just expand this FK around the Dirac points. You can easily find, again, you can just do it using Mathematica if you wish. So then you can find that FK, let's say, let me, okay, plus minus K, I'm just expanding it, plus minus capital K, and expand around those Dirac points with a small momentum K, and then you will find that in this small k limit, I will get it up, will be up. It's actually, I can't write equator here. It will be 3/2 times t and plus minus k minus kx minus ky and plus high orders, let's say k square. Or maybe even higher terms, higher order terms, right? So, so that is what we get by expanding my Hamiltonian or FK around those Dirac points. Then we can immediately write down what does the Hamiltonian look like once I expand it around the Dirac points. So similar as before, we also define a new field that we call psi, that will become the field of my Dirac Hamiltonians. We also did this in 1 plus 1D, right? So we define it as say A, just expand my fermionic fields, fermionic operators around those two Dirac points. Then I get the that's how we define the Dirac field, right? In 1 plus 1D story, what we did is that we expand the field at different momentum, right? Remember that the two Dirac spinner comes from plus 1/2 pi and minus 1/2 pi, but in this case now those two spinners really comes from the AB sublattice, of my system is actually closely related to the dimensionality of my system. But I will not go too far for that, along that direction. But it's some simple difference that you can easily see. So now, we can write down that the Dirac Hamiltonians will be, my Hamiltonian will be summation 3t over 2 and summation of k near my Dirac point, and then it's plus k dagger times sigma x, kx, sigma y, ky, and psi minus k. So that is the Dirac Hamiltonian for one flavor, right, at plus capital K, around plus capital K, and then I get another term for minus K. Plus sigma y, k y, and my, right. So that is the effective Hamiltonian that we have. So now I have two flavors of Dirac fermions. Yeah.
That'd be psi plus on the first line.
Oh yeah, thanks. So I have two flavors of Dirac fermions. Those two flavors correspond to that different Dirac point, because I have two Dirac points now, right? So that is the effective Hamiltonian for the graphenes. You may notice that there is an actual minus sign for the other Dirac cone, right? And we can make a convention that I'm now rotating my Dirac the two component of my Dirac fermions by I sigma y, and let's say I define a new psi minus, right? I'm here abusing notation a little bit, but now so I'm doing this rotation, and then after doing that I can write my Dirac Hamiltonians to be more compact, that is 3t over 2 summation of all the k and f equals plus and minus psi f dagger k and times sigma x kx plus sigma y ky and psi f okay, right. That's my final Dirac Hamiltonians. So now, as you can see, it's actually in the same form of the Dirac Hamiltonians of a quantum field series that I have talked about in the first lecture yesterday. So so that is the how we get Dirac Hamiltonians here. And next, we want to do is that now we want to understand the symmetries of this system, and in particular, whether those Dirac fermions are also protected by symmetries, and how to gap out the Dirac fermions. Right? Remember, in this 1 plus 1D story, right, it turns out that the translation symmetry can protect the Dirac fermions, right? And then to gap out the Dirac fermions, you have to break the translation symmetry, right? And we will also want to understand the similar physics here, right? What are the symmetries that can protect my Dirac fermions? And then after understanding that, we can then ask, how do I gap out those Dirac fermions? And it turns out that answering that question is very fruitful, because in the end you can naturally get what people called Chern insulator, that is a very important topological phase that even nowadays people are still studying it. So, all right, and another thing that I forgot to mention is that in literature, what people would usually call those two different Dirac nodes as a different valley. So, and then those plus and minus Dirac fermions, people would refer it as like valley index of Dirac fermions. Yeah, it's just a terminology that people are using in describing Dirac fermions in 2 plus 1D systems. All right, so any questions so far? So now let's try to understand the symmetries. So let me also explicitly write down what is my psi plus and psi the form of the two Dirac fermions in terms of fermions, because I have done this basis rotation for psi minus. So let me just make sure that everything is clear. Now I'm the new convention for my two valley Dirac fermions at different valley will be psi for plus it's the same, but now for minus valley it will my basis gets rotated. It's say B minus K plus K and minus say A minus K plus small k, right? That's my Dirac fermions. And we can also choose to write those two Dirac fermions in a more compact form. Let's say we can make a four component fermions that I call it capital psi. So now we can consider what are the possible mass what are the possible masses that I can add to my Dirac Hamiltonians, right? Then the key is that I'm just writing terms using matrix that are anti-commuting with my two poly matrix sigma x and sigma y, right? So then naturally what you can have is what you need to put is a sigma z, right? Because that's the only matrix that anti-commuting with sigma x and sigma y. And but now the actual degree of freedom that you can put is a matrix that acts on the valley indices, right? This plus and minus, right? So in my Dirac Hamiltonian, the valley indices are really just identity matrix there, but now for mass term, I can choose to put some valley, some matrix in the acting on the valley degree of freedom, right? So this tau just tau acts on this plus and minus degree of freedom. So and those matrices are naturally anti-commuting with my Hamiltonians sigma x and sigma y of my Dirac Hamiltonians, right? Those will be the mass term. So now what we want to do is that to look at whether how does those mass term transform on the symmetries. So and then we can understand the stability of my Dirac fermions, right? So then we want to consider what are the symmetries in the system in my Hamiltonian, right? Or on this lattice, right? So naturally we have the translation symmetry, right? This is a lattice. And so the translation symmetry really just maps, let's say, CA or CB to CA or CB, X plus A1 or A2, right? You can do any, you can translate it with any vector that is can be superposed by A1 and A2, right? Multiply an integer, right? That's a translation symmetry. And the other symmetry that we have is the C3 rotation symmetry. Around A or B, right? So obviously that's a symmetry that we have on the honeycomb lattice. And the third symmetry that we can consider is that we call a reflection symmetry. The third symmetry we can consider is that what we called inversion symmetry. So this inversion symmetry maps, let's say, between A and B. Actually, let me draw a honeycomb lattice here. So the inversion symmetry is that, let's say, we take an inversion center at, let's say, at the center of one bound, and then make it to, then we define the inversion symmetry. And then for the inversion symmetry, it's really just a maps, let's say, my two coordinates x, y to minus x and minus y, right? That's how the symmetry x look like. The fourth symmetry that we can consider is that is a reflection symmetry. So the reflection symmetry looks similar to inversion symmetry, except that now I'm not using a inversion center. Instead, I'm using a reflection axis, right? And then I just reflect the lattice, and it's obviously it's invariant. It also maps A to B, but then in terms of coordinate transformation, it maps x, y to x and minus y, right? It doesn't change it doesn't give a minus sign to x, right? That's a reflection symmetry. And the last symmetry that we have is the time reversal. And the time reversal acts as doesn't change my operators, but it's anti-unitary transformation that whenever I have I, I will put a minus sign there, right? That's the symmetries we have in the model. So you may also write down some other symmetries, right? For example, you can define a center that's say in the hexagon, and then you will have this C6 rotation symmetry. But it turns out that this C6 rotation symmetry can be also be rewritten as some combinations of those symmetries. So then it's kind of redundant, and we don't need to consider it here. Right.
Yeah. So why do we not consider, say, inversion or reflection type symmetries in the 1+1D case? Is it because there's no, I don't know, sublattices?
There they also have, but I kind of skipped there.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Or is it that they don't give us any additional constraints?
I don't quite remember the answer, but I guess yes. It also gives some constraints.
Okay.
Yeah. Here, you will say that actually some symmetries doesn't give you constraint.
Mm.
Yeah. So so that's the symmetries we want to consider, and then we can ask how does those mass term transform under the symmetries. I don't think I have enough time to explain how does those transform. I will leave it to next lectures. but maybe I have five minutes. I can just first let's say just work out how does it transform, how does the translation works. Okay, so let's look at translation first, right? We did this. We also did this for the 1 plus 1D, right? So remember that the translation, let's say for both for let's say for A, it's well let's say we translate it along the A1 direction, right? I will get a momentum dependent phase factor, that's exponential minus I capital K plus small k and times A1, and say A K capital K plus small k, right? That's how does my fermions transform. And then you can work out that for this capital psi, it will transform like exponential minus I capital K plus K times A1. And for the other value, it will be minus I times minus capital K, right? Because remember that those two values have different momentum, right? That's why I get a different phase factor here times A1 and psi, right? And you can write it in a more compact form, let's say exponential minus I k times A1. You can just insert the value of the capital K and A1, then you get exponential minus I 2 pi over 3 and exponential I 2 pi over 3. So that's what we get, and you can also rewrite this guy as some as polymatrix. That is minus 1/2 tau 0 plus I, right? So then having this, you can then show that indeed the mass term tau x or tau y, sigma z psi is forbidden. But it doesn't forbid mass, let's say sigma z and tau z, sigma z, tau allowed. So now in this case, the translation symmetry is not enough for me to gap out the Dirac fermions. And here, it's very intuitive to understand that why such mass term is forbidden, right? Such mass term, if I write such mass term in terms of those fermions living on values, they will look like let's say, psi dagger plus psi minus, right? It will look like something like this. Right, that's the scattering between two different values. It will carry finite moment. That's why translation is forbidden them. And if you look at those mass terms, it's only acts on the same value, right? It will not carry any momentum. That's why it's will not forbidden by the translation symmetries. And then other symmetries will do the job of forbidding it. I will leave the discussions of those to the next lectures. So I think I can stop here and then take questions if there is any.
Just a clarification.
Yeah.
The tau matrices also have the same forms as the polymatrices.
Yeah. Tau is also polymatrices. Yeah. Any other questions?